Hi there, and welcome to Leadcast. My name is Maria.
And I'm Essie. In this podcast, we talk to successful business leaders and professionals about their career paths and leadership.
We go under the surface and hear about the highs and lows of their careers, good and bad advice along the way, and get insights into how to manage a career and life in general.
So if you want motivation, tips, or encouragement for your own career, or simply enjoy inspiring and personal career stories, you're listening to the right podcast.
Today, our guest is Martin Reeves, the director of the BCG Henderson Institute, a think tank for new ideas in strategy and management. He's also an author, a TED speaker, and a regular contributor to Harvard Business Review, Fortune, and other management journals.
He's based in San Francisco and has also lived in Japan and the UK and Eastern Europe. Martin has 5 children and likes to spend his free time walking, reading, and playing music. Welcome to our Leadcast pod, Martin. We're very excited to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
To kick off our discussion, what's something that we can't find on your CV? Do you have any hidden talents or skills that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I'm not sure whether it's a skill, but I collect mostly and play a little bit wind instruments, clarinets, recorders, flutes, saxophones, that sort of thing.
Oh, so you collect them. How many do you have?
I have quite a few babies.
So you heard our introduction of you, but how would you describe yourself in your own words?
Well, as an introvert, that's a very difficult question, but I'd say I'm a playful, curious, introverted, and impatient business strategist.
How would you say that your introvertedness is visible in your business or in your work?
Well, people think that introversion means shyness, but actually I love performing. I love presenting to, you know, hundreds or thousands of people, and I like to perform music. To me, introversion is where you go to recharge. So if I want to think something through carefully, I don't go and have a discussion with somebody. I go for a walk, or I go for a walk in the woods and think in solitude about something, and then I go back into the social world.
So you sort of need that time for yourself to recharge your batteries.
Yes, yes.
So let's talk about your career and start with that. You joined BCG in London over 30 years ago, and you later moved to Tokyo, where you led the Japan healthcare practice for 8 years. What made you move to Japan in the first place?
Well, originally it was science, not consulting. So I went to study electrophysiology in Japan.
Wow.
And then I got interested in business along the way.
Wow. What's your best memory from Japan?
I think it is consulting in Japanese to Japanese clients, which is fairly similar to consulting to Western clients, but always with some interesting cultural twist.
Like what?
Well, for instance, ambiguity is considered to be sort of unsophisticated in Europe, but actually to be slightly ambiguous is to be very sophisticated in Japan. Also, Japanese makes very fine distinctions between formality and politeness. So exactly the tone and the words that you use with somebody depend very much on the situation. And in consulting, the most interesting thing is that for me, as a Westerner, logic is absolute. There's only one answer to 1 + 1, you know, it's 2. But in Japan, logic is interpersonal. It depends upon who is listening, what their motive is, what the situation is. And so it's very much an interpersonal calculation.
Oh, wow.
So depending on the situation, you can win an argument with a different set of facts?
You never win an argument. That would be considered to be very rude. But
okay, I would never fit in there. So since joining BCG, you have gained particular expertise on consulting on strategy to global enterprises across a range of industries. And nowadays, you actually lead the BCG Henderson Institute. And we'd love to hear more about the Institute. What does it do and what's its mission?
So the mission is to inspire, that's a deliberately emotional word, inspire the next game in the minds of business leaders, which are thought leaders, through the medium of ideas. So if in this age of where we emphasize technology, we emphasize implementation, it's a defense of the idea of the technology of ideas. And it's about not just informing, but it's about inspiring to action not in relation to today's business, but in relation to tomorrow's business. So what do we actually do? We research the ideas that we think are going to be important tomorrow. Sometimes they come from within business. Sometimes they come from beyond business. We write about them. We discuss them with CEOs. We try them out in pilot projects with curious, courageous CEOs that want to pilot new ideas. And then if they're successful, we try to have my colleagues in the broader consulting firm take up those ideas.
It must be such an inspiring environment to work in.
No wonder you haven't got bored to your work.
And they actually pay me last time I checked, so it's amazing.
Win-win.
So in addition to leading the Institute, you're also a TED speaker, an author, and a regular contributor to several management journals. So what's the best part of your job?
I think the best part is the core of it, which is seeing an interesting phenomenon or trying to describe an interesting problem and figuring out some new way of thinking about it, and then developing that seed of a thought into something which is useful, and then talking to people about it and persuading them of the usefulness and taking it to the point where you can actually try it out.
I'm almost jealous now.
And we have I'll tell you something a little mysterious about the process. So failure is to do that, and we fail a lot. Because obviously if you try new things, you fail. Fail is usually very specific. For instance, you got the wrong problem or people didn't understand you. It's usually very simple failure. Success is usually very mysterious. It usually involves many things going right. So we have a little ritual, which is we ring a bell when all of the stars aligned and things go right. And it's to remind us to reflect on what exactly just went right, because we don't just want to be accidentally successful. We want to systematically understand the science of harnessing the power of ideas.
Is it easy then to identify what have been?
No. It's like a detective work. I mean, they're solving the problem, and then solving the problem of why it worked is also usually a little bit of a mystery. Yeah. There's usually something about the concept, something about something the CEO already understood, something about the way they've explained it, something to do with the illustrations and the analogies and the language that we used. Usually capturing the success so that you can repeat and extend it is usually a non-trivial exercise.
So speaking about success, the theme of today's episode is actually winning in the 20s. And the year 2020 is well on its way, and our theme is winning in this decade, winning in the 20s, and you and your team have researched the topic, and we would actually love to dig into that research and hear how leaders should prepare their companies to thrive in this decade. But let's start with a question. How do you actually research the future? Where do you even start?
Well, there are a couple of ways of thinking about the future. One of them is to, as Gibson, the science fiction writer, said, you know, the future is usually present now, but not everywhere. So you can look for the future in the present. So, for example, if you want to look for an environment that is, you know, highly digitized, you'll find an environment where that's the case. If you want to look for an environment where population density is very high, or, you know, societal aging is very high, you can find that environment. So it's about looking at micro environments. It's also about looking at precedents. So what are the most successful companies doing? What are the most interesting companies doing? Another way to look at it is trends. You know, you look at the trends and then you say, what are the ones that really matter? Because usually, if you look at 100 trends, there are 5 trends which are driving those 100 trends. And usually there are 2 or 3 of those which are driving what I want to think about, which is competitive advantage. So you boil down the trends and you say, and then you do a thought experiment, counterfactual thinking. You say, if this trend doubled or quadrupled, what would change and what would be the consequences of that?
What are the trends that you have identified for 2020s?
Well, I think the basic changes which drive everything are fairly well known, actually. So one of them is the continued pace of technology development. So we've had a digitization, and we've had mobile, and now we're somewhat into artificial intelligence, and we'll have the Internet of Things, and quantum computing is coming along. So relentless technological change. I think geopolitical change I think the rivalry between the US and China is not something that will be resolved in one negotiation or in a year. History says that this will take several decades to play out. Both of those two things create a third important variable, which is uncertainty, which is we probably should presume a very fast pace of change and a lot of uncertainty. And then the fourth trend, which we can absolutely bank on, because a lot of trends are associated with uncertainty, but demographics is usually extremely predictable. So we have a slowing of population growth and an aging of population in developed countries that changes everything. I mean, it changes dependence ratios in society, it changes the financial structure of society, it changes the propensity for growth, it changes the returns the companies are able to make. So you put all those trends together, and then you begin to get some interesting consequences, if you'd like me to tell you about those.
Oh, absolutely.
So I think if I boil it right down, I think overall there'll be five things which are different about competing in the 2020s. The biggest one is essentially that learning is the new execution. So if you think about it, we use the word execution a lot today, chief executive officer, executive committee. It's as if executives are there to execute efficiently. And of course, there's nothing wrong with efficient execution. It's just that if everything is constantly changing, then you need to learn how to do new things, not execute old things. And then a second thing which reinforces that is that we have new tools which actually accelerate learning, like artificial intelligence. So I think that one of the big fundamentals that will change in business is that we'll start to compete on the rate of learning. It's not, am I bigger than you? Am I more efficient than you? It's, am I learning faster than you? And then that has a second big consequence, which is to build the learning organization. Organizations' hierarchies are built to cascade instructions and execute instructions very efficiently. But the learning organization is designed to learn new things. And learning requires a different sort of organization. It requires people to try things, so it's very local. It requires them to share what they learn with others, which is very global. And then it requires the whole corporation to adopt what has been learned, which is also very global. So that's a different type of organization. And then we have a massive problem, which is how do we synergistically combine the power of artificial intelligence and people to create a hybrid learning organization? So that's number two. Number three is change. So what I've said already implies a lot of change. There's just one small problem. In fact, there are two problems with change management. One of them is change, and the other one is management. Otherwise, everything is fine. Change management is very important. Everybody's doing it. It doesn't really work that well. 75% of major change efforts fail. And so I think it's time that we applied science to change management. So one of our big research themes is the science of change. In other words, what type of changes are there? How can we use data to predict change? How can we use real-time data about change to modulate change? The fourth of the fifth big implications of the trends that I laid out is diversity. So diversity has been, we're all a bit bored with diversity, I think. We've been talking about diversity for years, and we talk about it as an ethical imperative. Women should have a fair try, and ethnic minorities should have a fair try. Just two problems. One of them is that we haven't made very much progress. You know, senior women in management has only increased 1% in the last 10 years. So we've been saying it, but not really doing it. And then the second thing is, it's no longer just an ethical imperative, it's now a business imperative. Why? Because diversity equals cognitive diversity equals innovation and resilience. And we can prove that. We can prove that more diverse organizations innovate and grow faster. So we really need to create accountability around diversity. We probably all know somebody that got fired because they didn't meet their sales target. Do we know anyone that got fired for not meeting their diversity target? We need to take it that seriously. And then the fifth of the five implications is that, business, the population is very dense now. We have a very high density of business activity, and we're beginning to see the side effects, right? We're beginning to see global warming and plastics problems and inequality. And those are not later problems. They are now problems. They threaten to spoil the game of business now. So we really need to think well beyond corporate social responsibility, corporate responsibility, sustainability, and start to co-optimize for social and economic benefit. When we think about our strategy, we must think about both things at the same time. So that's a bit of a mouthful, but that's basically what I'm thinking about for the 20s.
That's a great description of the five imperatives for success in the 20s. How, if you'd have to pick one of these imperatives, which one is the most important for businesses to succeed?
Well, I think competing on the rate of learning drives everything else, in a sense, almost everything else.
It's like a building stone for it.
Right. It's a key driver. It's the thought experiment I told you about. If we were competing on the rate of learning, what would that science fiction world look like?
Do you think we'll have chief learning officers in the future?
Well, we already have chief learning officers, but they have to. We have to have learning organizations, right? So everybody thinks they're a learning organization, and in a very trivial sense, every organization is a learning organization. Everybody has an accounting 101 course, you know, but that doesn't really mean in a deep sense you're a learning organization. What I mean is learning how to do new things, new relevant things, more effectively and more rapidly than your competitors, at the level of the whole corporation. That's what I mean by the learning organization. That's not trivial. So I think the most interesting imperative is number two, which is what does the learning organization look like? And let me describe to you why that's interesting. So AI will take over what is called the correlative tasks of humans. If this happens, what else happens? Correlation. Simple processing tasks. And why do we know that? Because the history of technology says that if we can do something, we will. And we know that we can read x-rays with machine learning better than a radiographer. So it will happen. It won't create much value unless we get the hierarchy out of the way of the autonomous learning systems. Because if we take this instantaneous and perfect x-ray reading result, and then we put it up and down the hierarchy, essentially we've destroyed the point, right? We've destroyed the speed. There's no point in having a Porsche if you don't have a road, you know? And so that's one thing, right? Get the hierarchy out of the way of the machine learning. The second thing is, so what do the humans do? Well, humans can do counterfactual thinking, imagination. They can think about things that are not the case, but they could be the case, imagination. Machine learning cannot analyze the data for things that don't yet exist. So this is a uniquely human domain. And human beings can do empathy. And humans know about human purpose, right? Only we know because we decide. We are the humans. We decide why we have corporations, for example, or what this corporation is supposed to do. Humans have ethics. We don't yet, very embryonic field, but we don't yet have AI ethics. So there's a lot of things that humans need to do. So the humans need to do the human stuff. And then your third problem is, you need to be doing this on multiple timescales, as we said, milliseconds and weeks and months, but also decades. And then a fourth problem is we need to be doing this on multiple spatial scales. Why? Because it's not just the corporation anymore. It's the corporation, the ecosystem, and the planet. So we need to think on all spatial scales. And then we need to think about the interfaces, which is, if we got everything right that I just said, we still have a problem, which is the machines can't really talk to the humans because the machines have too much data. They're black boxes. We don't really understand why they've reached a particular conclusion. So we can't tinker with that conclusion and test that conclusion. So there's a huge amount of work to be done around interfaces. Now, to the average corporation, this sounds like science fiction. To a handful of corporations like Alibaba and Amazon, this is what they're trying to do.
You actually predicted my question, which was going to be if you've seen companies do this kind of learning organization in a good way already, and if you could name a few concrete examples, because indeed this sounds very complex.
So the vision I laid out is a personal speculation. You know, it's based upon trends and precedents and scenarios. It's probably wrong. Hopefully, it's directionally correct. But it's not what we're all doing today. So is anyone doing it? I'd say nobody's doing all of it. But there are corporations that are trying to do parts of it. So competing on the rate of learning, you know, the video streaming company Netflix is absolutely competing on the rate of learning. Because if you think about it, they offer $1 million prizes for algorithms that better predict which viewers are going to use what based upon their previous viewing data. And why do they do that? Because if they can predict what content people want, they'll know which content to pay for, and the content rights are very expensive, and then they'll attract more people to their video streaming service in a very competitive environment. So that's a learning loop, right? Which is you have people use the videos, you collect the data, you use algorithms to make predictions based upon the data, you have a data flywheel effect. So that's competing on the rate of learning. It truly is competing on the rate of learning. In terms of building the learning organization, Alibaba explicitly talks about what they call the self-tuning organization. Self-tuning organization is the idea, it's like a radio. Old-fashioned radios, you have to tune into the frequency. The radios in your smartphones automatically tune themselves into the frequency. So their idea of the self-tuning organization is the organization that is constantly adapting to the environment. In other words, constantly learning from the environment. And not just the surface part of the organization, the marketing, but the deep inner parts of the organization, like the supply chain and like the planning process, and like the HR process. So that's an example of a corporation that's absolutely thinking about building the learning organization. In terms of the science of change management, Microsoft is using what it calls workplace analytics, which is collecting real-time data on things that are happening in the workplace, like communication patterns, like sentiments, for example. And we begin to have new types of sensors. I was talking to someone the other day that has a startup that measures engagement. People walk around with a little earphone on that measures whether their brain is engaged or not. And it turns out that most of us are disengaged most of the time. That's a bit of a problem. So, but if we can begin to use these tools to be more scientific about change management, then that's obviously a plus, and there are some companies working hard at that. Diversity, there's tremendous spread of how well different companies are doing on diversity. Some are really advanced. In this part of the world, there are some companies that have a lot of women at the top, but the average corporation has, you know, two or three token women board members, whatever the law requires. And so clearly it's possible, and that's actually the easiest one in a way. Like it's surprising to me that we haven't made more progress on that front, because it's like very valuable, and it's may not be easy, but it's the most controllable variable of everything I've spoken about. And then on the social dimension, Klaus Schwab, the head of the World Economic Forum this year, called on all large companies, all World Economic Forum members, to declare net neutrality for carbon emissions. And we begin to see some very bold announcements on that front. We don't yet know how companies are going to achieve their pronouncements, but I think the game is changing. It's gone from saying things that demonstrate your good values to making major commitments that will shift your business model to be able to meet, because corporations can't be successful in a non-sustainable environment.
This episode of Leadcast is done in collaboration with AmCham Finland.
AmCham Finland is the leading English language business network for Finnish companies looking to succeed in the US market,
as well as for international companies working to grow in Finland.
Talking about especially the building, the learning organization, what kind of leaders are needed? What sort of characteristics are necessary?
I'm not sure we fully know the answer to that question yet, but clearly the sort of leader we don't need is an extrovert, commanding figure that issues instructions based upon experience. Why? Because you can't deliver instructions for unknown environments. So what's the alternative? The alternative is setting the context for learning. So the leaders of the future are more likely to be people that ask good questions, or encourage people to ask good questions, and who create a learning environment, for instance, one where failure is not punished. And then, you know, probably a second characteristic of leaders that we need for the next decade is that they have long-range leadership. In other words, they're influencing people well beyond the borders of the company. Why? Because we have to deal with these social issues, and what I call corporate statesmanship. You know, you must have influence on the outside world beyond the business. And also, business ecosystems are very important now. Groups of tens or hundreds of companies that collectively create value, business ecosystems, seven of the world's largest companies are now business ecosystems. And 10 years ago, the answer was 0 to 1. So that's a huge change.
We've actually talked in this podcast about corporate activism and influencing and how it's not enough to serve merely shareholders any longer. How do you see this development evolving in the future? Will we see more of this?
I think so. I mean, we need to figure it out because mankind's biggest problem right now is climate change. And there's been a lot of talk, a lot of solutions, a lot of science, but the fact is that emissions are accelerating, not decelerating. So we're going in the wrong direction still. So we need some major shift to bring that into focus. And we probably have to change a lot of things. We probably have to change how we measure success, so not just narrowly total shareholder returns. We probably have to ask, you know, who are the stakeholders in that success, multi-stakeholder capitalism. We probably have to think differently about business models. We probably have to, another idea that we're working on is something called sustainable business model innovation. It's about the idea of thinking about the sustainability of the business model, not just the efficiency of the business model for value extraction. So it's as if we need to focus more on the value that a business model creates for the extended system of the business, including economics and society and the planet, before we talk about extraction. We can't just extract, and we don't yet know how to do that. So all of that is unlikely to be solved with one simple concept or one simple paper. I think that's a very hard problem that we need to work at. And by the way, we can't just work at it at the level of corporations, because some of these problems require collective solutions. If we need collective action, you know. Otherwise, we have things like free rider problems and limited incentives for everybody to magnify the efforts of others.
Mm. And that does require a different kind of leadership to engage all the stakeholders for these shared missions.
Well, that's another idea we're working on, which is called systems leadership, which is we actually need to think about change at the level of systems, for instance, at the level of industries or at the level of entire economies or at the level of cities. Because if you think about it, we can't just say oil companies are bad and therefore they should fix their game, because we consume their products, right? So we have to change the whole system. I can't say oil companies stop using oil and where's my energy. It doesn't make any sense. We have to fix the whole system. Who's responsible for the whole system? Well, ordinarily it would be governments, but there are two problems with that right now. Many political systems, bi-party political systems, are breaking down. So it's unlikely that we're going to get initiative from major geographies right now. And then the second problem is that this is not a national problem. Essentially, governments are designed to solve national problems. This is a global problem. We don't really have a global government.
Indeed.
Listening to you, it's clear that you're very engaged and inspired by your work. What would you like your impact to be for the world?
Well,
Small question.
Small question. I think we'd like to solve it all.
That would be great.
I'm pretty sure you will, actually.
Exactly.
Well, we want to make the maximum impact on the world through the medium of ideas. And, what are some of the biggest problems that we have? The ones that we've just been talking about. So the maximum impact on those ideas, but not just on paper, as manifest in the behaviors of people that influence other people's behaviors, i.e., in the minds of the thought and the businesses of thought leaders in business. Because business learns from business. You know, business doesn't say, what does that academic paper say? They say, you know, what's Toyota doing or what's Netflix doing? Okay, that seems successful. Let me do that too. So it's creating those precedents. And then, in terms of the little machine that I manage, I'd like to breed the next generation of thought leaders. You know, I'd like to amplify our capacity to solve these problems by creating new thought leaders within the Institute.
I'm sure you will. You are. Let's move next to our second challenge. So we'll give you short, quick questions, and we'd like to hear your first answer that comes to your mind. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
What was your childhood dream job?
Solo clarinetist.
How about your first job?
assembling boiler parts as a summer job, heating boiler parts.
What's your favorite place?
My favorite place is probably a country lane, like a muddy path through a field that leads to a stream near my hometown in England. And it's called Merry Tom Lane, because apparently some lord or something called Tom fell off a horse there and hundreds of years ago. So it's called Merry Tom Lane. And it was just a place of childhood wonder.
Oh, sounds very idyllic.
What's the latest book you have read?
I read Machines Like Us by Ian McEwan, which is a sort of science fiction novel about an AI dystopia. It's about robots that are as functional as humans, but the whole thing goes wrong.
What motivates you at work?
I think curiosity, discovery, and also working with young, fresh, brilliant minds, which know no limits.
And the other side of the coin, what annoys you?
Oh, bureaucracy, procedure, inflexibility, fixed ideas, arrogance, know-it-alls, all of that I find very annoying.
What would you like to improve in yourself?
This is very easy. I've had problems throughout my life with patience. I'd like to be more patient. It seems fairly unlikely at this point, but I'd like to be more patient.
So what makes you laugh?
I think sometimes it's good to think about absurd scenarios. Take an idea to its complete limit, to the limit of absurdity, and it's fun to think about it. It makes you laugh, but usually there's a serious side to it too. You laugh because you're breaking a taboo, and sometimes there's a productive idea in the taboo. I also like laugh when I observe my little girls trying to figure out how the world works. Like they were trying to figure out the other day, how does dating work? What's a date? What happens on a date? Why do people date? And like from first principles, they were trying to reason themselves to like, what is a date? And I thought it was very, very funny.
Did you offer any good parental advice?
I wasn't sure how much to offer actually.
So what's your guilty pleasure?
Well, I like to do yoga and meditation. So, in a busy working life and with kids and things going on, it feels a little guilty to take purely personal time to do absolutely nothing. But I actually think it's very, it's a delicious guilty pleasure to do absolutely nothing and to try to empty the mind.
I think it's a necessity these days.
Yeah.
So what's an everyday routine you couldn't live without?
I think chatting to my kids. So I don't spend as much time with my kids as I would ideally like to. So I try to make sure that every little moment counts. And if you really focus, you can get a lot of value out of those morning conversations and those evening conversations. So that's an important part of the routine.
And then to finish off, we have a couple of questions. What advice would you give to your younger self if you could travel back in time and meet 18-year-old Martin?
I think one piece of advice would be to be even more reckless and irresponsible. there's plenty of time to be sensible. Youth is a time for playing. I think I played fairly hard, but I could have played even harder. As a young professional, it would be not to compare oneself to others or to imagine that there's a right way of doing things.
That's an excellent advice. And what's your biggest or most important insight on working life or actually life in general?
I think I've come to admire what I call gracefulness or doing things with minimal force. It's something I got from yoga, the idea that you can usually achieve more with less. So I think I've always been very driven, maybe quite forceful. And I think I've learned that if you identify the leverage points, you don't really have to push that hard. Just a little flick will do the job. So I guess I'm thinking more nowadays about where are those leverage points.
That's well said, to achieve more with less.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Martin, for this conversation. It was great having you as our guest.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.